Tesla took investors by surprise Wednesday when it delivered a profit. The electric car maker has a poor track record when it comes to meeting its own targets, but it breezed past those troubles in the third quarter by cutting costs and delivering a record number of cars. The news sent shares soaring 21% in after-hours trading.
While nearly a dozen U.S. states allow recreational marijuana, all states prohibit driving under the influence. But there hasn't been an easy way to prove it until now. Several companies in the United States are preparing to market cannabis breathalyzers, including Hound Labs in Oakland, California, and Vancouver's Cannabix Technologies. Cannabix's THC breath analyzer could be cheap enough at a few hundred dollars per unit to potentially allow parents to use them.
Libra is going to be backed mostly by dollars, and I believe that it will extend America's financial leadership around the world, as well as our democratic values and oversight. But if America doesn't innovate, our financial leadership is not guaranteed. I actually don't know if Libra is going to work, but I believe that it's important to try new things, and as long as you're doing so responsibly. That's what has made America successful, and it's why our tech industry has led the world. But I also hope that we get a chance to talk about the risks of not innovating. So we co-wrote a white paper to put this idea out into the world and to start a conversation with regulators and experts and governance.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's October the 24th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell. We've got another business day here underway. Lots going on in the world of business. We'll get to some of the numbers from the stock markets around the world here momentarily. We call that your morning intel. We'll give you a sense of what Wall Street might be doing today in just a few seconds as well. We'll get to some of the latest news. You heard a little bit of it there in the opening montage. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, being grilled yesterday on Capitol Hill. And Tesla, wow, what some surprising results from Tesla. Not only is their share price up nearly 21% in after-hours trading, but they've almost erased some of that $1 billion they lost during the first half of this year. So some positive news from Tesla that we'll update as well. And all of the other business news, sports, weather, and traffic as we move through the 5 o'clock hour this morning. On the opening bell today, it's Thought Leader Thursday, and Ed Curry is here from Associated Bank. Is now the time to refinance your mortgage? Maybe, maybe not, is the short answer to that. And we'll get to Ed here first up this morning, a little bit later in the program. Finally, some positive news about how to deal with all of the plastic in the world. And some researchers and scientists at Northwestern University and also at the Argonne National Laboratory are involved in this. Turning plastic into treasure coming up at about 5:38 this morning. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. The opening bell will ring this morning. After a roller coaster ride yesterday on Wall Street, investors continued to look at recent earnings reports, but remain optimistic even after some reported disappointing results. Yesterday at the closing bell, the Dow ended up about 46 points. The S&P gained about 8. The NASDAQ increased about 15 points. This morning, as we look at the futures markets, Dow futures are up just 16 points. S&P futures are up just 2 points, just fractionally, and NASDAQ futures are up nearly a third this morning, up about 30 points. In Europe, markets are mostly in the green. In London, up nearly 0.75%. In Germany, up more than 0.5%. In France, up about 0.5%. The trading day coming to an end in Asia with the Nikkei in Japan up nearly 125 points, nearly 0.5%. In Hong Kong, up nearly 231 points. And in China, off just a fraction, and oil in the United States is trading at $55.62 a barrel. You heard the montage piece from Mark Zuckerberg yesterday. Part of the testimony also came from a New York Democrat, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was questioning Facebook's advertisement policy. Freshman Congresswoman grilling Zuckerberg during a congressional hearing about the social media giant's decision not to fact-check political ads. She questioned how far she could push the policy, including asking if she could pay to target predominantly black zip codes or advertise the wrong election date. Zuckerberg said that content would be removed because of policies about voter suppression, contradicting what he had said earlier about not checking, fact-checking politicians on that side. The U.S. trade envoy is trying to get Democrats to go along with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. The trade representative, Robert Lighthizer, met with Democratic lawmakers yesterday to try to resolve their concerns about the trade agreement. Republicans would like to pass the USMCA deal by the end of 2019. Amazon is expanding its network of package pickup points. The company announced it was adding thousands of new locations throughout its new partners of its counter option. It allows customers to grab their packages in-store at staffed partner locations. Amazon's new partners include GNC, Health Mart, and Stage stores. Officials say Counter was launched in June and has already brought tens of thousands of Amazon customers to partner locations. Let's begin this morning with Thought Leader Thursday. There are some up and down news about mortgage interest rates, and that's having an impact on the not only the refinance market, but the initial mortgage market as well. Ed Curry is with us in the Thought Leader chair this morning. He's a certified mortgage planner and construction loan specialist at Associated Bank. Ed, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the current snapshot of where we are with refinances and mortgage activity. I know the Mortgage Bankers Association was out yesterday with some numbers that say there's been a decline in activity. What are you seeing?
You know, seeing a little bit of both. It's spotty. Rates obviously don't go down or up in a straight line. So what we tend to see on a very short term, whether it be weeks or maybe in a 30-day period, is you'll see periods within that, call it a month, where rates are declining. So you'll see, fortunately, a lot of clients take good advice, jump on, lock in a rate, and then start the loan process to refinance their home. So what I tend to see in refinance-type markets are start and stops for lots of refinance activity and then slowing refinance activity. So right now, over the past couple of weeks, rates have kind of inched up a little bit. So all the people that locked in about 3-4 weeks ago when rates were lower, they're all working themselves through the process, getting the loan approved, getting the appraisal done, not as many applications. And then at some point, I think we'll see rates slide back down, and then that whole cycle will start back over.
I want to talk a little bit more about the rate part of that in a second, but I just want to hit those numbers. The Mortgage Bankers Association says overall applications fell 12%. Again, these are national numbers. Refinance applications dropped about 17%. Loans for new homes to buy new homes fell 4%. Tell us where the 30-year, where we see kind of rates at right now.
It bottomed out maybe 3-4 weeks ago. There was some 3.5% money for borrowers with good credit, good equity, and you're probably up to about 3.75, 3.875, depending on the scenario. So it's moved up a little bit, but I would anticipate that we'll probably see further opportunity over the next 6 months for lower rates.
If the buying opportunity, if the opportunities here or the business here for you is in construction of new homes, those loans to go to new homes, that seems like a positive sign that people are building homes.
It really is. It's not only the new homes, but rehabbing their current homes. So, it's been talked about the lack of supply on the market. So I think one of the indications of that is people are going out looking for a brand new home that maybe they can build or be turnkey, and they're not finding that home that they really love. They know they like most of their neighbors. They know they like their street. They like the school that the kids go to. So a lot of them are just saying, you know what, let's be here another 10 or 15 years. Let's bump out the kitchen. Let's put on a second floor, whatever we need to do, and let's just improve the home that we have. So that's helped out quite a bit on the construction side. Major rehabs, we're seeing a lot of that type of activity. Some of the higher-end brand-new builds, we're seeing that slow down this year a little bit, but still at a pretty good pace.
So when somebody does that construction, they're redoing their home, I always thought that would be you take out a second mortgage on your home. But there's actually a product that's for construction itself.
Absolutely. You tend to have three different scenarios. People who have a ton of equity that will tap into it maybe through a cash-out refinance of their first mortgage or a second mortgage, a home equity line of credit. But in many cases, either A, they don't have the amount of equity, or B, the amount of the cost of construction is so much that they don't have enough equity. Mm-hmm. So a construction loan, a specific construction permanent loan, allows you to take advantage of the future equity. So just like a regular loan, there's only one appraisal that's done, and the appraiser is going to look at your current home. It's going to take in account the work that you're going to be doing on it, the cost, the specific information on that project, and it's going to, he or she will appraise the home at the future value or the home as complete. So if you're starting with a $200,000 home and you're putting a second floor on it, they may appraise it for $400,000. So now you can get a loan based on a $400,000 value rather than that $200,000 value, and that's going to allow you to tap into that much more equity. So theoretically, if you have enough equity there, and equity, again, is based on that new appraised value, you can finance the entire project if you have if the appraisal comes in at a certain point.
It feels risky. That kind of feels like a risky loan, is it, or not?
It's not. It's a regular loan for us. Rates are very similar, if not the same, as regular type loans. So ultimately, there is certainly that risk in the period during the house is under repair or under construction. But, you know, based at the end of the day, we found that good borrowers pay back loans.
Yeah.
And most of these loans that we're doing are for people's primary residence. They need a place to live. So you tend to see default rates on these as low as you would see a regular home.
So the construction, we'll play this out into the future, the construction ends, the home is suddenly a new two-story home that's worth $400,000. Do people, you mentioned people stay in those homes, do they then get another refinance after all of that happens and make that into one mortgage, or how does that work into the future?
It's actually the same mortgage. So you're closing on this loan upfront before construction begins. It's a regular mortgage. It could be an ARM. It could be a fixed rate. And there is no closing. There's no reappraisal, no credit check. There's no anything after construction is complete. The only thing that changes is during the construction phase, payments are interest only for what you owe. So you start at a lower payment, and that builds up almost like a line of credit as you draw the funds. And then after construction is complete, the only change is the payments just go from an interest-only payment to a principal and interest payment. There's no other change.
Can you explain to me again why, when we have had two rate cuts, that mortgage interest rates are still going up?
Absolutely. And we've touched on this previously a little bit. It's not about what the Fed does, is what the markets believe the Fed will do, or what the direction of the economy looks like it will be. So the best time to lock into a rate is when there's concerns about the economy slowing, when there's a belief the Fed is going to be cutting rates in the future, either more aggressively than they currently have, because the markets are always guessing what the Fed's going to do. So that's going to bring the rates down. So it's a buy the rumor, sell the fact type scenario, where once the Fed does something, you tend to see mortgage rates move a little bit higher.
And do we expect another interest rate cut coming from the Fed?
I do at some point. There's some Fed governors that have said that we should be good for the year. I could see it go either way. Inflation numbers this past month have fell a little bit, or a little softer than expected. So they could have some cover to cut rates based on that. There's some economic data that's been weak. Some of the services, the PMI, manufacturing and service sector numbers were weak. Some of the economic data, we've seen the weakest we've seen in 10 years. So there certainly could be reasons on both sides to cut 0.25%. I don't think the market's going to freak out either way. I don't think mortgage rates are going to move significantly mm-hmm. either way based on what the Fed does for the remainder of the year.
Talk to us a little bit about the housing inventory. What has all of this that we've been talking about, the mortgage rates, the applications, what is it doing to the housing supply? Because I've seen some numbers where the inventory, national housing inventory, down nearly 3% in September.
You know, I'd love to see more studies on this. Anecdotally, I don't see a strong correlation between mortgage rates and supply of homes. Certainly does have an impact. If you were to look at a graph over the past 3 years, especially the last 6 months, as rates have dropped, supply has fallen. So there's certainly a correlation there. I think one of the biggest impacts on the supply that we've seen this last cycle really is builders not wanting to go out on a limb and build new homes, especially large neighborhoods. Think back 10 years before the last housing crisis, you'd hear from friends saying, oh, I'm moving out to this city. And you're like, is that still a Chicago suburb? So, you know, there were builders that were really going out on a limb and buying large swaths of land far away, people driving into the city to work for an hour and a half, 2 hours, because they could buy a huge home for a small price. You don't tend to see that happen this cycle. I haven't seen too many large subdivisions built. So there's not a lot of new housing being built. The supply of labor to build those homes has been much less than it has in past years. And land cost is really expensive. No matter where you're at, city of Chicago, it's really expensive. I remember in 2011, clients in the North Shore were buying teardowns for $200,000, $250,000 and building a home. And now in many of those communities, that's $400,000 to $600,000 for just a plot of land to build a home.
Yeah, and I found one of the statistics from this housing supply story that I found said that about 5 million entry-level homes nationwide have been turned into single-family rentals because the people who had those didn't think that they would be able to sell them anytime soon.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's still a significant amount of homes. While the country as a whole has expanded quite a bit and done well, there's some areas, certainly in Chicago, where there's a lot of homes that are still underwater. So turn them into rentals and make some money off them.
You know, there have been a couple of stories about other places, and I'm thinking of some international cities. But you mentioned San Francisco is one of the places, too. I believe there were a couple of other major cities like Los Angeles and New York that were included, where there are these. There's concern that there are housing bubbles getting ready to break. But not so much here in Chicago. Is that what you're thinking as well?
That's what I'm seeing as well. You know, they say Chicago is a city of neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So there's certainly some neighborhoods where entry level to build a home can be $1 million, which just, you know, gives me chest pains that I'm not building those homes. But there's certain other areas where it's lagged significantly for the rest of the city. So overall, yeah, there's certainly a lot of great value. You tend to see, whether it be neighborhoods in the city get overbought and prices move higher aggressively, and people just simply move over to the next neighborhood or suburbs. In the North Shore, from 2011 to 2013, those prices moved up significantly, and people just moved a little farther out.
Yeah, there was some data released by UBS, the investment bank, that said of the two dozen major city housing markets, Chicago has the least risk of being a bubble that could burst.
That's good.
Yeah, that's good, right? Ed, how can people get a hold of you if they want to have a one-on-one?
Feel free to shoot me an email at ed.curry@associatedbank.com. That's ed.curry @associatedbank.com.
Great conversation. We'll see you next time.
Thanks again.
Ed Curry is a certified mortgage planner, construction loan specialist at Associated Bank. Thought Leader Conversation every Thursday here on The Opening Bell. You can also find more on our website at WGNradio.com and head over to associatedbank.com/thoughtleadership to learn more about our thought leaders and hear more conversations there as well.
Now, WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Thursday edition of The Opening Bell. A team led by researchers from Northwestern University and Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont has developed a new method for turning plastic trash into high-quality liquids. It's a development that could help address the massive global issue of plastic pollution. And joining us this morning is Max DelFerro, chemist and group leader at Argonne National Laboratory, to talk a little bit more about this new advancement. Max, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having us.
If watching Shark Tank has taught me nothing else, I have to ask the question, what's the buy-in here?
Yeah, I want to be very honest with you. I think we are a little bit far away to be ready to go production. This is a basic science discovery. We are really excited about our discovery. We think probably we need other 5 to 10 years to be ready to be commercial. what I think is an exciting discovery that can really change human beings.
I want to dive into it a little bit. So tell us exactly what happens here, because I think we're all used to hearing the stories of how our landfills and oceans are filled with all of these single-use plastics. There's even an island floating in the Pacific Ocean of nothing but plastic. What have you found? What is the process that you've developed, that your team has developed here, that might reduce some of this?
Yeah, the state-of-the-art technique to recycling plastic is called pyrolysis. Pyrolysis is a very high-temperature process that converts a bunch of plastics in fuel, like diesel and jet fuels. And I think it's a great technique, but we think in our team, between us, Northwestern, and Ames Lab, and other universities that are part of this team, I think there are new opportunities. And through discovery of new catalytic process of this new engineering process, we were able instead to make jet fuel, we were able to make lubricants like motor oil that you can go to a store to Jiffy Lube and buy your motor oil that you can put in your car. And that motor oil came from recycled plastics. And in particular, we are targeting films like food packaging, plastic bags, and we show that already that we can, for example, convert a plastic bag into advanced motor oil.
It seems like something that we thought might be able to happen all along, but there's a chemical process that prevented us from really kind of melting some of this stuff down and getting rid of it. Talk to us a little bit about the scientific part of why these plastics are so hard to break down and why they stay in landfills for so long.
Yeah. When I give scientific talk to my colleague, I ask them to think about it. We spent almost 70 years in making new plastics, meaning the scientific community spent 70 years to make new plastic with new application, with the idea to make stronger material, more resistant material, and we spent probably less than a year now starting to think backward. What we can how can we go back to the monomer of the polymer. I think for the scientific community, this is really exciting. There are a lot of opportunities here. Our catalyst is based on a perovskite support. Perovskites are well known in the scientific community, in the market, as a solar panel that can convert solar energy in electric energy, electric power, sorry. And in our case, instead, is one of the first few use this perovskite as a catalyst for a completely different reaction. And the active species of our catalyst is a platinum nanoparticle that we can control the geometry and electronics. And based on these two parameters, now we can control the products that we can create, we can regenerate from plastics. You were saying?
Yeah, no, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No problem. And so far, we target two different products. We are targeting motor oil, as I was saying before, or waxes. And waxes can be further transformed, for example, in detergents or cosmetics. These are the two main groups that so far we are thinking as a product that we can generate from a plastic bag.
And so, as you look forward into the future here, there is, back to the Shark Tank part of this, even though the development still has a ways to go, you can see how this could be a hundreds of billions of dollars idea.
Correct. I think the Department of Energy that supported our research, I think as a long-term project on this the plastic problem, we are looking for collaborators on the private sector to further develop the technology. Of course, right now we are at the lab scale process, but there are a lot of things that we can do. For example, the scale up of the catalyst. We are looking for on the technical economic analysis to see if this technology makes sense from a market perspective. And also there are limitations in the engineering, on the process design. Right now, we are on the batch system, meaning it's a closed system, but probably for real industrial application, we really need to think about a flow process, something that we put the plastic in, and after 5 minutes, we have our products.
Max, one of the things you mentioned earlier, this could be like 10 years away from seeing this being used on a regular basis. Each year right now, 380 million tons of plastic are thrown away, and that could quadruple by 2050. It feels like we're in a race against time here. Do you feel that pressure as well?
Yes, you are 100% right. There is a lot of pressure. The good thing, I think, that there are now a lot of people and also the community that are really see the problem. I think a lot of companies are investing a lot of money. There was an article yesterday that BASF, the German producer, is investing $20 million in this new technology, in looking for new technology for plastics. One thing that I want to also make very clear, that plastic at the end change our life in better. Means think about all the medical application, the food packaging. Plastic at the end is a good thing. If we are able to find a way to really chemical recycle this plastic, I think we are in a very good shape.
Why didn't scientists who were developing plastic do the back end part of this, as you were talking about, at the same time they were developing some of these hard plastics, these long-lasting plastics? It feels like had that been done while they were developing these plastics, we wouldn't be in this situation right now.
Yeah, that is correct. I think it's easier to make the plastic than depolymerize the plastics. It's a thermodynamic problem. Again, it's much easier to make the polymer than deconstruct the polymer. And also there was not any incentives or a long vision to see the problem of plastic pollution.
Let's take us into the future here. If your team is successful and this becomes something that we can do to get rid of plastic, is this going to change how all of the rest of us discard plastic and recycle plastic? Will there have to be a fundamental change in the way that we throw all of this stuff away?
We need to consider both processes. There is a big problem in the recycling, in the how to separate and plastics. There are really big limitation, engineering limitation. It's a cultural problem. We put everything in the recycle bin, different kind of plastic, with glass, with aluminum. I think we should learn a little bit more from Europe, where they have different bins, waste bins for different kind of plastics, and that could help also the recycling facilities to help with the final product. It's a socio-economical problem. I think the population should start to see that this is a problem and we need to do more. I learned from my wife, she said, but no waste. When we go to buy grocery, we don't use any plastic bag. We don't use any plastic to collect our grocery. And that, I think, will be important. But again, plastic really changing better our life. I'm thinking, for example, medical devices.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, this process that we discover, I think, is just one of them. We need to think about with a more open mind and think about more opportunities. This is one of them. I don't think it's the unique, and I request my scientific colleague, to really think about other opportunities and other processes.
Yeah, and your team is not the only team working on a possible solution. I'm guessing there are many, many teams around the world trying to find the answers to these problems.
Yes, correct. Again, the Department of Energy that sponsored these researchers started to be interested in this polymer upcycling, polymer recycling, 2 years ago. I think Europe, like I would say before, they are a little bit ahead of us. But we are going to catch up very fast. Probably the best scientists to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is some optimistic news regardless. Max, thank you for being on this morning. Congratulations to your team and good luck.
Thank you so much, Steve. Really appreciate it for having us.
Max DeFerro, chemist and group leader at Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont, along with researchers from Northwestern University and teams across the country, developing this new method for turning plastic trash into high-quality liquids. Could be a game-changer in the plastics problem in the world.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward a positive open on Wall Street later this morning. Dow futures are struggling to stay in the green, up nearly 22 points, but NASDAQ and S&P futures are up anywhere from 0.25% to nearly 0.5%. A generally positive day in Europe and a mixed day in Asia. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. A fairly quiet day in the grain trade yesterday at the Chicago Board of Trade. Buyers of soybeans, for example, disappointed that China apparently did not make any new buying commitments for U.S. soybeans, and that disappointed traders. The November soybean contract ended up just 0.75 cents a bushel. December corn also up 0.75 cents, and December wheat up 3.5 cents a bushel in yesterday's trade. Little more action in the live cattle market at the Mercantile Exchange yesterday. Futures hit their highest point in 5.5 months. Tighter than expected beef stocks and rising cash beef prices triggered some active fund buying and took prices through key technical resistance levels. So at the end of the day, the October live cattle contract was up 32 cents a hundredweight. The October feeder cattle contract gained $1.35. And hogs moved slightly lower. The February lean hog contract down $1.12 a hundredweight. Well, we're now less than a week away from the beginning of the 92nd annual National FFA Convention and Expo in Indianapolis. That gets underway October 30th, continues through November 2nd. More than 67,000 FFA members from across the U.S. representing 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands expected to take over the city of Indianapolis. Hotels within 50 miles of Indianapolis are all booked for that convention next week. That's agribusiness. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Thursday, October the 24th. Durable goods orders for September lead off today's economic reports. Analysts forecast 0.6% decline from August when the numbers come out this morning. Also today, economists expecting nearly 203,000 workers filing first-time claims for unemployment benefits, 11,000 fewer than last week. New home sales for September are due today as well. Industry analysts see those coming in at an annual rate of about 697,000, a 2.2% drop. Big day for earnings as well. Baxter International, Amazon, American Airlines, Visa, GNC, and Southwest all reporting quarterly earnings today. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Thursday, October the 24th.